2, season 4, episode 5, I believe.
I think that's about it.
What that means, but let's just wait. Episode 4. Sorry.
Oh, okay. There we go.
So I'm Ethan Bird.
And I am Michael Collins of the IRA. No, I'm Nick. And I am watching the rain fall outside my window because it just started as I speak right now.
Well, I think that's the rain that you got from us, dude, because we're a fair bit west of you and it was raining here really heavily a few hours ago. So you can thank us for that.
Well, I'm not going to thank you for anything. You damn dirty Midwesterners. You can kiss my Yankee ass.
We are Yankees too, dude. What the fuck?
Oh, yeah. You're from Ohio. You guys are Yanks. You guys are.
All the Midwest are Yanks.
Yank descendants.
Well, I guess not.
And also, Ohioans pretty much. Soldiers from Ohio pretty much won the Civil War for us.
General Sherman was literally like the last based person from Ohio.
Yeah. And who's like the next biggest name in history from Ohio? The Taft family? Literally the
McKinley.
Biggest.
McKinley. Well, McKinley was first, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. I always forget McKinley's from Ohio. That disgusting.
He's pretty close to me, like a 45 minutes away from here. There's this school named after him that's from like his hometown.
Oh, God. Just a disgusting, putrid corporate monster, McKinley. Like, literally, there's no other president who can be described more accurately as the Rockefeller president. Because original Rockefeller and the original Carnegie and the original J.P. Morgan were like, yep, this is the guy we got to make sure is president. This has to be the president. And they just bought the election. They straight up were like, all right. We barely have secret ballot, so like let's just pay people to vote for who we want them to vote for. We have enough money to do it. People are broke enough. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean,
and then to make sure it worked, we just pay the people who count the votes to tell us who's winning, to let our guys in.
Of course, before Sherman, there was most space person from Ohio, which is John Brown.
True. To whom were Sherman's men singing?
Yes.
About whom were they singing when they marched through Georgia?
Yes.
John Brown's body is moldering in the grave.
I'm not sure if Brown was even born before Sherman, but Brown was died earlier because he was executed for. And for a raid which PragerU condemned.
Yeah, because PragerU is just explicitly pro-slavery now. Just explicitly. So I read, where is it? It's somewhere over here. It Can't Happen Here. Who wrote it? Sinclair. Not Upton.
Yeah, I think Sinclair Lewis. Yeah, you were on the right track.
Yeah. He wrote It Can't Happen Here, a novel which is literally just like him in 1935 being like, what if there was American Hitler and American Nazis and they took over and did Nazi stuff in America? And what we were just talking about made me think of the scene in that book where the Hitler guy becomes the Democratic nominee for president. And like, he has like it's hilarious because there's two really old guys who are Civil War veterans from each side carrying the Confederate and Northern flags. In this like big long almost like embarrassing procession. I'm like, that's PragerU at this point. And they sing like a stupid song about like the strength of Lee and the wisdom of Lincoln or something like that, and all I can think of is just like, yep, that is trigger you at this point. Like, we are the Republicans. We are the party of Lincoln. We are the real anti-racists. Democrats are the Klan party. They're the real racists. And then 5 minutes later, they're just like, by the way,
radical anarchists,
all those Republicans in the, all the Republicans during the Civil War, all the people who were Republican during Lincoln's administration, all of them were filthy communists who wanted the government to do overreach.
Yeah,
slavery wasn't that bad, guys. Like, just like, okay, pick. That's the funniest thing to me. This is totally off topic from what we were talking about discussing before we got on.
Well, it's whatever,
but,
man.
Well, let's just go with it. Let's just roll with it. That's my favorite thing among all the Republican, like, weird Republican race narratives. Like there's this weird thing where Republicans are like, their propaganda machine is so, it's everything is run so top down, so tightly. It's such a call and response thing where, like, the people in right wing propagandists will just straight up spout a line. And then all their viewers will repeat it word for word. And it, so like, you'll get normal people on the street who speak to you like a press secretary or a PR chief or representative for somebody, and just give you their talking points, like bit by point by point by point. And they're, and my favorite, the most insulting ones when it comes to like race. And the Republicans trying to be like, we're not racist, is we are the party of Lincoln, but also states' rights. And the Civil War, but also get over slavery. It was a long time ago. You know, like all the whole, like that whole period of time doesn't matter. You know, like, who cares about it? Because I love that. Because, like, I remember we just to, like, in like 2015, Judge, what's his name? Napolitano, who's the Fox News judge, wrote a whole book and had a whole big fight with Jon Stewart because he went on Jon Stewart and they debated for like 15 minutes about it. Judge Napolitano basically, like, tries to claim that Lincoln was the bad guy. Because Lincoln didn't have, quote, slavery was his, I'll never forget it. Him just staring Jon Stewart in the eyes going, slavery was dying a natural death. And it was needless and unnecessarily violent and probably caused more suffering to fight a war to kill it prematurely. I'm like, bruh. So, like, you'll get people who be like, we're the party of Lincoln. Lincoln was the best. We love him. He's us. He's our founder. He's our first president, our first Republican president. The Republicans are the party of Lincoln. And Democrats were the Confederates, it was Democrats who ran off and founded the Confederacy. It was the states that voted Democrat that formed the Confederacy. They're the party that, the Northern Democrats were the opposition to the war, or the opposition to Lincoln, and they opposed and tried to slow down, and ultimately are the people who ended up implementing Jim Crow, segregation, black codes, etc. And they were the people defending and resisting every attempt to get rid of slavery or whatever. It's like, which, I mean, like, to an extent, true. Just historically true. But also, that's all true and has never stopped being true. Democrats are the Klan. That was true, and it never stopped being true all the way to today. And also, and Republicans were the party of Lincoln and the party of equality and justice for everybody, and that never stopped being true. But also, we are the party now of states' rights, and we're the party that says a state should be allowed to do anything. And also, Lincoln wasn't really not racist. He was racist. And, you know, like, that's like the weird neo-Confederate talking points that Republicans can't help spitting out. And that's the whole thing with PragerU. They love Democrats are the Klan videos. They make so many of them. Dinesh D'Souza made a bunch of them for them. And meanwhile, they could not but help themselves in saying also making a whole, you know, making a whole video where they say, also, by the way, John Brown was a villain. He was a criminal. He was evil and crazy. And Robert E. Lee was a good guy who did nothing wrong in his entire life. John in fact, fighting for the Confederacy was a good thing. Like, what? Okay. Prager, you will go from Democrats tried to destroy the Union and love slavery and hate Black people to no, actually, slavery wasn't that bad, bro. Get over it.
Yeah. And speaking of idiotic people, I hear that the show Rising, which we've talked about at length last year on this podcast, is about to be discontinued.
And thank God.
Splitting up and going to second place. Sorry, breaking news alert.
Thank God. But it makes so much sense because, I mean, like, Crystal's on Crystal and Kyle, and Sagar's bosses at the Hudson Institute must be like, all right, bro, you can't keep letting this woman talk over you. You got to start throwing our talking points out there, dude.
Yeah.
And that's my favorite thing about The Hill, by the way. It's a riddle wrapped inside a mystery, wrapped inside an enigma, man. It's The Hill. It's like aesthetic, the way it presents itself. It's like self-serious tone. It's all very like beltway insider centrist, not quite fully lib. Like yeah. DC lib, you know, lanyard lib, not, you know, super progressive, not even like socially super progressive, just like very bland, like Bill, you're still stuck in the 90s. Like, the era of big government's over. Like, that's The Hill aesthetic. Like, this is about The Hill, the sacred place of the Capitol and the hallowed halls of Congress with their arcane, time-honored traditions and rituals and norms, right? Like, the mystique of it. And that's what The Hill seems to be, like, referencing in its aesthetic. Yet it runs this show which portrays itself as like the pop in Rising, that is like, we are the anti-establishment, populist, progressive and nationalist, like counter programming. You know, we're the cool, edgy ones that suddenly undercut it. Meanwhile, the person who owns The Hill is like some raging chud billionaire, pro-Trump MAGA lunatic. And then Sagar, who's supposed to be the right-wing, you know, the right-wing quote-unquote populist, who, you know, I'm not like other Republicans, baby. I want you to have health care. No, I don't support Medicare for All or any of the plans that any Democratic candidate proposed for expanding health care coverage. I just don't support the libertarian free market model or Obamacare either.
I don't support.
Sagar has said things that sound like he supports a single payer system or something before, and then just blatantly said he doesn't support. Like, he'll say things where he's like, "Yeah, everybody should have health insurance, man." And then like Crystal won't be like, "Well, whenever he said he didn't support Medicare for All, Crystal would never be like, "Hey, what do you support then? You always say you want everybody to have healthcare. This is the way to do it. What else? What other alternative is there?" And he never has one. It's literally the Trump talking point of everybody will have healthcare one day. It'll be great. It'll be fine. And then doing nothing about it, trying to take more people's healthcare away.
Well, yeah. And Sagar said he didn't support Bernie Sanders because of his stance on marijuana legalization.
Which is like, sure, that's the reason why.
But the fact that Sagar is still opposed to weed legalization when pretty much
everyone. Yeah, well, that's one thing.
The every person his age in the country supports it by now, basically.
Yeah, Sagar has fully demonstrated, especially since the Black Lives Matter protests, and I think that was when like he hit like his breaking point, where like, because remember, he works from the Hudson Institute. So, like, and this is what I was getting at earlier with like, it's a riddle wrapped inside a mystery, inside an enigma. You know, it's this Russian nesting doll in The Hill of how awful it is, where it comes off at first with this bland centrist aesthetic with And then pulls out of nowhere this like populist anti-establishment show. And then, well, actually, it turns out the owner's just a normal Republican rich guy who owns a media outlet, loves Trump. Sagar is actually an employee actively on the payroll of the Hudson Institute, which is explicitly self-described as neoconservative. It's a neocon think tank that held, that carried water for Bush, for both Bushes, for the Republican Party, for the Iraq War, for the War on Terror, for all of that crap. And continues. And at home, carries water for the drug war and the prison industrial complex. Basically, everything that you could consider establishment in this country, as is typical of neocons, that is what they're there for. That's what the Hudson Institute is for. And Sagar hosts their podcast. He hosted a podcast for them. He works for them. They employ him. He's like a fellow while on at certain points while on Rising. Like, the dude is literally, you cannot be more committed to a political program than working for a think tank and towing its party line. He can call himself a communist if he wants. He is, for all intents and purposes, a neocon. And that is honestly the truth with all of the so-called populists. Because all of them, on a dime, said, all right, yeah, you know what Tom Cotton said? We should bring out the troops. You know what? Martial law is a good thing. We're the populists, by the way. We believe in people power. We believe in resisting tyranny. By the way, martial law, good idea. Because we're not scared of big government, I guess. Also, $15, we're pro-worker. By the way, $15 minimum wage, unions, and any sort of jobs program or jobs guarantee, any public and any real avenue of public investment, bad. Communism doesn't work, evil. And it's like, okay, how are you pro-worker? Oh, well, we want to deport a bunch of immigrants. Immigrants hurt workers. Well, immigrants are workers, one. And they don't actually hurt the workers that are already here that much. Not nearly as much as the things you don't want them to have. And I mean, just like now it's gotten real obvious because Sagar was he's basically openly promoting the bioweapon theory.
Well, it's yeah.
About COVID, which is actually one of the things we talked about before recording.
Right. But just one segue into that is like, the Hill, they're like, we are against the military industrial complex, we are against the establishment, we are against the Washington consensus or whatever,
we're against endless wars.
But then when the CIA puts out the conspiracy theory that COVID is a Chinese bioweapon, they're all over that. You know, that's the CIA talking point that they're fine with taking, you know.
Yeah, it's just, and it's so insulting. Like, at this point, Sagar really has shown that, like, if there's going to be any such thing as right-wing populism, or there's going to be some sort of, you know, lowercase p populist or popular pitch that the Republicans have going forward for themselves, it's going to be like, we're pro-worker in the sense of we don't like, you know, we're anti-elitist in the sense of we want to make people with humanities degrees or who attended a school of liberal arts, we wanted to make them feel bad. That's anti-elitism. Being pro-worker and against big business means saying that big tech is scary and not on your side, but also doing nothing about it. Because guess what? A bunch of your financial backers are other just less well-known players in the tech industry, like Peter Thiel, one of the biggest guys in biggest and richest guys in Silicon Valley. Like, that's another one of the funny things is that these people talk about big tech all the time and how big tech is teaming up with the radical left. You know, and like, you hear that a lot on Fox News.
Yeah.
Tucker says it a lot. Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, even, I think, has said stuff like that. You get all these people, you know, it goes from Fox News outward to like OAN, and the other weird one, Newsmax, yeah, and then into Breitbart and all the little media outlets that they have out there, the Daily Caller even, like all of that. And it said, and they'll say, you know, big tech's aligned with the radical left or whatever. Meanwhile, like Peter Thiel is basically a fascist who doesn't believe women should be allowed to vote. His business partner and friend, Elon Musk, is the other like big tech guy. And he is, he is a Republican donor who apparently like provided a crap ton of money to the California Republicans. And is flirting openly with the same COVID conspiracism that Republican officials have been promoting. And the whole idea of like the billionaires and the elites in this country on the left is obviously laughable for obvious reasons. But then, even then, like you get down to like the nitty gritty, like, oh, well, they might be liberals. But like, no, a bunch of them aren't even that. A bunch of them are just, there's a bunch of weird right wing wingers in the super rich, super well educated. There's a bunch of weird right wingers in there. There's a lot of them. I guarantee you, I'm going to look this up right now. Okay, never mind. I looked up something too broad to figure out quickly enough to keep reporting this. But what I was going to say is, like, I'm sure if you looked it up, you'd find, like, because a lot is made of the not college-educated Republican whatever, right? Like, the white man without a degree, the white man without a college degree of a certain age, I guess, who votes Republican, where it's like, that's very small. It's going to necessarily be a small sliver of people. A lot of the Republican base are people with college degrees, just that their degrees are in business or management, or are like a throwaway liberal arts degree that they used, that they ended up going into business anyways. Like those guys, a lot of them become Republican. Like a lot of these just, like it's easy. You can get a college degrees don't make you a college education doesn't make you immune from being a racist, a sexist, a religious fundamentalist. There's a lot of evangelical fanatics out there who are very far right with degrees in business management, you know. But you know, that's
4 degrees in poli sci, as we know from our camp, you know.
Oh yeah, or degrees in poli sci, as those of us who are poli sci majors are learning, have learned, there's a bunch of right wing psychopaths in poli sci.
And centrist psychopaths too.
Yeah, those two.
Yeah. We've got the future. The future of America truly is. Don't let any vaguely progressive boomer Facebook moms let you be fooled into thinking that this next generation is some kind of great hope.
No, all of our right wingers below a certain age are probably closer to Nick Fuentes than they are to George Bush. Like terrifying people. Actually scary. And of course there's also just like the probably larger, numerically superior base of people who are just like that you get all in any generational cohort, which is I was raised with a lot of money. My daddy has been able to pay for everything. I'd like him to keep that. My parents are doing rather well under Trump. He's not that bad. You know, like there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that, like, to be frank, dumbass conservatism out there in this country where it's just like, what? Trump's like an asshole on Twitter, but he's not that bad. My parents are doing great. We've kept the summer house. We're getting a renovation. You know, like
Well, to be fair, dad just bought his first boat. He's been talking about that forever. You know, like, okay.
Well, to be fair, Nick, what kind of conservatism at this point is not dumbass conservatism?
True. What kind of anything in at this point in America is not a dumbass version of itself?
Even the left.
Even the left is a dumbass version of
itself. Especially the left, arguably.
Yes, especially. Yes, of course, especially. Like the weird transformation of China. This is a thing that I noticed years ago in like 2014. The big thing on the online left in 2014 was, who did you call the good guys in Syria? That was the big thing. And people were legitimately treating the Syrian civil war as if it was the Spanish civil war. It was like, well, actually, I put Makhno or Daruti in my profile picture, and I support Rojava. I stand with the YPG, the YPJ. They're building a real living project of anarcho-syndicalism in the real world. It's a real revolution there. And then people being just some very odd folks who, would say stuff about how, actually, no, the Kurds are American puppets, so bad. Bashar al-Assad, the Lion of Damascus, based, gonna destroy ISIS and all the terrorists. And people who made it their whole thing to just, like, fangirl the Assad government. And then, of course, the weirdos who actually did like support the not Kurdish rebels, who were mostly racist Islamists like violent ethno-nationalist Islamists who want to probably do some kind of genocide once they take over, and people being like, well, actually no, the FSA really does support liberal democracy. And I was just like, what am I looking at here? What is this? This does not, one, have nearly as much import as the Spanish Civil War did, right? Like, there's not a fascist dictatorship somewhere that's, sharpening its teeth on winning the Civil War in Syria for whoever they're backing, right? there's not some fascist superpower with a war machine revving up through arming, the FSA or Assad, right? There's no like Communist International or anything. There's no international movement where like different tendencies are vying for hegemony.
What are you talking about, dude? I have a Discord server. That's the same thing.
Yeah, all those jokes about Trotskyists with newspapers can now be made about people who call themselves, who describe their ideologies with either an abbreviation or as just leftist and have Discord servers.
Stop erasing my contribution to the online revolution, man.
Yeah, and I remember that. It was just a bizarre, it was just a really weird, cringe, wannabe, very LARPy reproduction of the Spanish Civil War and the sides and debates that happen on it. Where it's like, guys, this is very lazy. Assad is not Stalin and Rojava is not Catalonia. This is insane. You guys are being crazy. This is a whole other situation. The similarities are civil war and region that is semi-autonomous and has an ethnic minority in it. That's it. And I guess it's also very weirdly similar because of the oddly and very vaguely similar positioning and like shape of Syria and Spain, so that ethnic minority happens to live in the northeastern corner. I just realized that as I was saying it, like I was picturing Spain and Syria on maps in my head. And I was like, damn, actually there are parallels here. The Kurds are in the northeastern corner. The Catalans are the northeast.
Maybe those guys were right, Nick. Maybe.
They are actually both anarchists. YPG's actually kind of complicated.
You're saying now the new Syria is China? Is that what you were going to say? Or
well, what I'm saying is that like it's the same thing happening with China, where like
China is the Soviet Union. And you, as a leftist, must, as someone on the left, redefine yourself and totally orient all your politics and action and organizing and associations. And everything you say must be oriented around China and what your position is on it. Are they good? Are they bad? Thumbs up, thumbs down. All right. Well, thumbs up. You have to defend every single thing that they do. You're a tankie now, apparently. You are the same as someone who was totally chill with Khrushchev sending the tanks into Budapest or Brezhnev sending the tanks into Prague. And of course, it's not at all the same in any way. And if you, you know, go thumbs down, if you're one of these like anarcho-liberal people who's, you know, you call yourself an anarchist or a libertarian socialist, a term that which I used to identify with because I was confused and non-committal. I look back at the term libertarian socialist and think to myself, oh, what a wonderful, stupid term. You know, like, what is
your identity now then, Nick?
Huh?
What is your identity now?
No.
You refuse to answer?
No. We're, I would say, I don't know, what would you identify as, Ethan?
Well, I don't know either, but.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. I mean, like, Doug Lane, the editor or publisher of Zero Books, yes, publisher, always likes to describe himself as a baby Marxist. I would describe myself, I've read a lot of Marx, I would still just call myself a baby because I haven't finished Capital because it's so long. And it's not as hard, I get the whole, like, it's not that hard to read trend, but it is kind of hard to read. Capital is very hard to read. It's very long. And when you just see a check, when you try to start a book that's literally the size and shape and consistency of a brick, and you're in the beginning, it just gets so daunting and intimidating, you put it down. But I would still, but you know, I've watched enough educational like lecture series and read enough other things written by Marx and Engels and by Marxists describing the ideas in Capital to get what I'm talking about, to make sense. I can carry a conversation about it. And I've read a crap ton of other Marx stuff, including the economic stuff that he wrote in the process of drafting Capital. He had to get himself up to writing Capital because it's a, you know, God, you can imagine the effort it takes to write something that big. So I would say, like, yeah, like baby Marxist is how I would identify. And I mean, yeah, socialist.
I'm sorry for revolutionary that. That was not my intention. But anyway, Nick is absolutely right. There is a tendency. And there's actually someone that on Twitter named what's his name again? Named find his profile. It's like a communist guy from Taiwan. Oh. Xiang Yu, yeah, he's saying like Westerners or people in America specifically that have to identify themselves by their opinion of China, whether you're pro-China or anti-China, none of that really matters because you as an individual
have no say.
You know, has no say in the U.S. foreign policy. I mean, there are things that every individual can do that can be great for the good of, you know, humanity. For example, like don't commit hate crimes against Chinese people, or don't like, you know, spread U.S. propaganda online or whatever. But like, at some point, you have to recognize the undeniable fact that.
I think I tweeted something out like this, because with it, when it comes to China, there is like this weird contingent of people who have gotten way too deep into it as people who self-identify as on the left in America, right? Who have gone so deep and are so angry at China for some reason. They got so angry at it or about it and have dug themselves so deep into being the opposition to China on the left, the left critics of China or whatever. And get themselves so worked up about it that they're like almost following that the same arc that a bunch of Trotskyists followed during the early Cold War, the Irving Kristols of the world, who went on this long arc from, I am a Trotskyist member of the Young Communists League. Committed communist, a Trotskyite communist, a Bolshevist Leninist, as they might have called themselves during the 30s. And, but then, their position grows, well, actually, Stalin betrayed the revolution and Stalin destroyed socialism in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union's no longer a socialist state that embodies the dictatorship of the proletariat. It has degenerated. It is a deformed or degenerated workers' state. Or, later on, eventually after Khrushchev, Trotskyists were saying it's state capitalist. Once you get to that point, Trotskyists start getting angrier over time. It's being like, the Soviet Union betrayed it's not just that Stalin betrayed the revolution in the Soviet Union. Now the Soviet Union betrays the revolution around the world. And we have to act. And in fact, we hate the Soviet Union so much that to us, even aiding in the destruction of the Soviet Union, aiding even the imperialist capitalist West in defeating the Soviet Union, or cheering them on in their struggle against it, is actually in the long term a good thing for the cause of world revolution. And that's how you get this weird pipeline that people talk about, of the Trotskyist to neocon pipeline. Because a lot of those original neoconservatives were originally Trotskyists who went so far in the anti-Soviet direction that they ended up supporting American imperial foreign policy and things like the Vietnam War. And during the course of the Vietnam War is really when a bunch of their minds broke and they became full-fledged right-wingers. And there's this weird, that anarcho-liberal crowd is getting so, so anti-China and so worked up and so just like, well, and like the whole, I'm not even mention the person whose name just popped into my head. I'm not even invoke their name. But this particular person was very, 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 very upset with and went on a very big war, big crusade against tankies and tried to debate them and spent all these debates just acting like a petulant child and just kept yelling Uyghurs over and over and over and over and over and over again. Just genocide, 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 just yelling genocide over and over and over again. Which is like, would you really act this way if you really believed it was a genocide? I wouldn't act like a pet. I wouldn't treat genocide like the favored cereal of a spoiled petulant child. I would treat it like the serious, horrible human tragedy it is. But also if you're American, you have, there's more genocides you should, there's genocides that you are, the blood is on your hands for, that you should, they're a bit more of an immediate concern to you than what may or may not be happening in China, which we also just plainly don't have enough evidence to call fully a genocide. Something might be going on. I'm not sure. Whatever it is, I don't think I like it. But I'm also not going to sit around and change a profile picture or something and
donate money to groups that are pretending to be Uyghur charities, but are actually fronts for the NED and the CIA and USAID. You know, like, I am not going to be an idiot about it, partly because I know there's, this is, that's the real tragedy there, which is like, whatever's going on, no matter how horrible it is, as an American, you probably have no power over it. Because it's within China. But my point is, like, people like that who have convinced themselves that China is like the new Nazi Germany.
Well, they literally draw the comparisons directly.
Yeah, but like, it's the Soviet Union under Stalin mixed with Nazi Germany. Like, you smushed them together. Because all these anarchist types have convinced, you know, all their debates about the Soviet Union are automatically dumbed down by the fact that all of them hate it right away. And it's all dumbed down to just, it's like, well, capitalism, private property, and Soviet Union, the state owned all the property, but wage labor, you know, like, state capitalism works like 2 plus 2. And so they're already like, you know, China's a state capitalist dystopia, and also it's a dictatorship, and also it's this totalitarian nightmare. Now they're doing genocide. Like, that's just fascism. Oh my God. And I can see, like, some of the, like, anti-China people on the left going down that weird, like, a weird, like, a dumbass version of the Trotskyist to neocon pipeline. Where it's like, one, this is all happening on the internet. Like, at least with the Trotskyist guys in the 50s and 60s, at least some of them, due to certain commitments and certain involvements and their level of commitment and the fact that they were heavily involved in politics for a long time by then, in communist politics, they probably knew, were justified in having a high level of emotional investment. Because who knows? Maybe they knew people who died. You know, maybe they knew people who were getting killed over this shit, you know? Maybe they had a friend who volunteered in a Trotskyist militia in the Spanish Civil War that got betrayed by a Soviet-backed one and got murdered or captured by fascists and tortured or something like that. Or had, you know, relatives back in Russia who had been persecuted or whatever. Under Stalin. So maybe there was, like, at least back then, there was, like, for those Trotskyists, a real seriousness to the debate, like a real weight to their issues with the Soviet Union, to their criticisms, like the revolution just happened and within a decade it was betrayed and our best chance for socialism has been stolen away from us by Stalinoid revisionists. And, you know, we are, and you know, oh God, it just happened right in front of our eyes, and they're killing people. You know, there's real blood, you know, being spilled, real skin in the game. But this is just like a bunch of people arguing over the, treating China like a football team and arguing over it on the internet. And these people are getting just as worked up and putting themselves on the same exact ideological journey towards becoming imperialists, basically.
Yeah. Did you want to talk some about Palestine?
Oh yes. It would serve us well to revisit that, because things have developed. There is a ceasefire. That finally happened, and the Israelis broke it.
It happened one day after the Palestinians started striking.
Yes.
You know.
Oh yes. That is the big
part of the story as well.
Yeah, Palestinians went on strike. There was a so Palestinians went on strike across basically the entire area. So Arabs, you know, the so-called Israeli Arabs, the Arabs are Palestinian citizens of Israel, you know, Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, who live within the borders of Israel proper, and the Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza in the occupied territories, all went on strike in solidarity against with the victims of the recent Israeli massacres. And they, you know, basically demonstrated that Israel cannot function without Palestinian labor, which really shows us, it's one of those ones that really elucidates the paths here. And this was something that we were getting at in the last episode where we talked only about Palestine, where, you know, at certain moments in history, you realize that there's only a limited number of options open, real options. There's all sorts of possibilities, right? There's all sorts of things and combinations of events that can happen and combinations of chains of events that can lead us all down all sorts of, you know, an infinite number of potential timelines. But at certain moments in history, the real paths, the ones that are real possibilities, ones that are the ones that can only be taken serious, the ones that can be taken seriously, right, that are meant to happen, we're seeing them. We're just talking about history. The Russian Civil War is one where people like to talk all the time about, like, oh, well, like, what would have happened if Stalin didn't come to power? Well, and you go through all sorts of events in the revolution to change that. Or what if, you know, Lenin lived slightly longer and made sure that Stalin didn't take power, and or some sort of power sharing agreement amongst more figures than just Stalin and his faction. You know, stuff like that. Or you know, like, what if the Republic, the Provisional Republic, continued, or things like that, where people will talk about that, where it's like, no, actually, when you actually look at it, what were the options open? The white generals would have been the real force behind any incredibly weak and by then incredibly unpopular Provisional Republic. Any liberal or social democratic government would have just been bulldozed over by a right-wing military junta or junta, which would have governed the country. And given what the white armies were doing, the Holocaust probably would have happened in Russia first. You know, like, it was that path. So it's either that or what actually happened, the Bolsheviks. You can't change when people live and die. That just doesn't happen. You know, you can't figure that out. So, or at least you can't change when they die of natural causes. And so, you know, you had two paths, the Bolsheviks and what ended up actually happening, or the white Russian military fascist dictatorship that would have done a genocide against probably the Jews and all sorts of other minorities in the Russian Empire. And with Israel, you're really starting to see the two paths that have opened up. You can dance around with all sorts of magical thinking and insane, you know, lanyard wearing idiot proposals about how you can make a two-state solution still work, how, oh, we can just do 67 borders and everybody goes back to their side of the of that border, and we get two states that can be fully recognized and fully independent and self-sufficient, and everything will be fine. Or, you know, some silly other version of that, which has been rendered impossible by the steady stream and encroachment of Israeli settlements in the West Bank and their Balkanization, their cantonalization of the West Bank and all its, you know, how all those communities are separated from each other. You get these like clusters of cities around like Ramallah and Nablus, I think, and like East Jerusalem, which is totally cut off from like the rest of the West Bank. And they're all the different Palestinian villages and cities are separated from one another by, you know, that segregated road network we were talking about, where the Israeli government, the Israeli military secures certain roadways through the West Bank that connect all the Jewish settlements together and that only Jewish people can drive on. And the military polices those roads, secures them, provides security and law enforcement in the settlements, and basically rolls into, you know, they are, and rolls into the West Bank to crush dissent in Palestinian areas wherever they need to. And so, you know, the situation is very clear here also that, like, you know, there's plenty of calls for on the far right edge of Israeli politics, of hard right Zionist politics, for basically genocide, just the full extermination of Palestinians. But it won't be like a nuclear Holocaust where they just vaporize Gaza overnight and kill all those people, just totally eliminate them, because Israel relies on the labor of these people. They cannot move enough people in to replace them, and they cannot logistically or in terms of PR at this point for sure get away with just killing every Palestinian and then just taking their land from them. They are reliant on their labor. The relationship is now codependent or interdependent. We are stuck with apartheid. A genocidal form of apartheid, which is slowly, painfully, tragically killing the Palestinian people. But they are stuck in with these choices. Apartheid, where, you know, in Gaza, it's just totally cut off from the rest of the world. There's no way of getting in or out. No person or thing can get in or out, right? Without the Israeli military being like, all right, go ahead. And so people are just going to sit there amidst the rubble, which cannot be removed or repaired because they cannot bring in building materials, construction vehicles, equipment, any of that. They can't bring in any of that. You sit in with that, you sit there in your rubble with your no electricity, no safe, clean drinking water, very little food. You know, you're sitting there half starved, thirsty, homeless, and completely uncared for. Your health, your hygiene, completely at risk, always teetering on the edge of collapse. And that is the horrific daily life of people living in this open air concentration camp in Gaza. And then, as we were just describing, the apartheid system in the West Bank, where there are all sorts of sweatshops in Palestinian areas and where settlements get all sorts of nice big investments in terms of capitalizing these communities, providing capital to them and building stuff there, building businesses there. And they're reliant on making sure that there's this desperate Palestinian workforce that is deprived, that is always at risk of dispossession for to be one that sort of is transient as well, that is that you can bring in to Israel. And of course they realized without Palestinian construction workers they couldn't build anything in Israel anymore, so all the Palestinian construction workers stayed home. They said, fuck you, let's stay home, fuck off, we're not building more crap for a country that kills our people, that is slaughtering them, is trying to keep us enslaved. It's an insult to our humanity. This is very admirable. And this is the situation, you know, like the Palestinians need, you know, this labor movement to kick off, where it really does show you the power of an organized working class that is aware of its own existence. The Palestinian workers are aware of their power. They're aware of what lies in their hands. And it's inspiring that was like the hammer that was brought down on Israel that forced them to say, all right, fine. This round is over.
But
for now. But then, you know, a few days later, we're going to immediately go ahead and do the thing that Hamas said that they attacked us for the first time. We're going to go immediately back to attacking peaceful worshipers at Al-Aqsa.
Yeah. All right. I think that we can stop here. Is there anything you want to close with, Nick?
Huh.
I would say
don't be a trot.
Yeah, don't be a trot. And especially don't be a neocon. Don't fall for people for any populism scams. Don't fall for any scams at all. Keep your money and your identity. Stay in drugs. Don't do school. Always take a shot of hard liquor before driving. And
don't do that.
Always. No. Do that. It makes you better. It's like a real rush, right? You get a real rush after you take a shot, right? It goes down. You're like, yeah. You feel like an engine. And you are. Your engine is revving up and you're ready to go. And that means you should go rev up the mechanical engine in your car. And you should go somewhere. You should drive yourself to Taco Bell. All the way there, no matter how far it is. The nearest Taco Bell. I don't know, or the nearest Wawa or Quick Check. I don't know if you have those out in Ohio. We have those in New Jersey.
I don't never heard of Wawa or Quick Check, but
oh fuck. I don't know what they have in other parts of the country. They're probably worse. They probably suck. But yeah.
And speaking of going somewhere,
take a shot of like some Captain Jack and ride that baby all the way to the nearest place where you can buy a good old sandwich and shove it down your gullet and then drive back home.
And speaking of going places, Nick is going to be going on a trip soon. And when he gets back, we can hear all about it. So
going down to Dixie, away, away.
Maybe you should sing your John Brown song while you're down there. See how they like that.
I will blast John Brown's body in the airport I'm going to be in the South. I'm not specifying more than that. Okay. It would be very weird if I did. It felt like, but you will all hear about it when I get back. Monday to Monday, there will not be an episode. There will not be a new recording. From Monday, May 31st till May 31st.
Till
June 7th. The next Monday, I will not be able to record anything till then. You'll have to do without us.
Harry.
So yeah,
have a good week.
That's all I got.
Have a good trip. Have to a your good specified week. Location.
Thank you.
And I will.
I'm starting that Maoist militia I've always been talking about that will wage protracted people's war throughout the Appalachian Mountains. That's the plan.
I'll have to come down and join you for that.
Hell yeah. Get Kyle. He has experience.
Kyle is somewhere in the South right now, I think. So, yeah.
What? Yeah. Holy crap. Actually?
His parents moved to Florida.
That'd be awesome.
Ago, so, they, I don't know. They're somewhere.
Oh, that's based.
Well, not really.
I have friends in Florida. But I won't be in Florida.
Yeah. Anyway. Have a good week, everyone.
Anyway.
Bye-bye, Nick. Bye-bye, everyone. Take care.
Bye-bye. Take care.